Of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers internships in 35 nations around the globe, here locally and in Washington, D.C. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarship. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Today's guest is Henry Zokolski. Henry Zokolski is the executive director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center at Washington, D.C. It's a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization. He currently serves as an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C. He previously served in the Pentagon as Deputy for Nonproliferation Policy, and received a Medal for Outstanding Public Service from the Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney. Please join me in welcoming Henry Zokolski.
First of all, I'm incredibly impressed by the IT savvy of this school. I struggled to get this presentation put together. I'm going to apologize in advance. It was put together after many hours, and it disappeared. So this one was put together in 60 minutes. Actually, not that long ago. So I think it'll help, though, so I will stick with it. Today, I'm going to talk about a topic which is a little awkward or odd, but important, and I think will become increasingly important. It has to do with Israel's nuclear weapons program and our government's promotion of a nuclear weapons-free zone. I shouldn't say nuclear weapons-free zone, a weapons of mass destruction free zone, which would include chemical weapons, biological weapons, it would include nuclear weapons, it would also include certain nuclear-capable missiles, according to some accounts. It's a work in progress. It's not like there's a draft treaty. Let me see if I can make this work. Now, the reason it's an awkward topic is twofold. First, if you look at the number of countries that might be involved in negotiating such a scheme, it's enough to make you snicker, I think is the word. How do you, I mean, do we have embassies in every one of those countries? I mean, I assume so. But that's a lot of folks to be dealing with a lot of different views and a lot of different problems and a lot of different perspectives. There's something of the academic about this project, if you will. So serious people probably give this topic the back of their hand. I mean, by the way, one of the first jobs I got in Washington was at the National Intelligence Council at the CIA to look into this idea. That was in 1980. So what is that, 35 years ago? It's not a new idea. The other reason it's an awkward topic is it deals with Israel and a taboo or a forbidden topic, and that is their nuclear weapons program. Now, to get some idea, I didn't have time to get the picture. I really wanted to have an additional picture. The picture would have been of the current president of the United States, Barack Obama, dodging a question from Helen Thomas in his first press conference. And she asked, "Mr. President, can you name one country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons?" Well, he did a very good job of not answering that question, and he really did not answer it. And it was almost embarrassing. You can go on YouTube and look this up. You just type in Helen Thomas, President Barack Obama, Middle East nuclear weapons question press conference. It'll come right up. Yeah? If I had the power to do it, I would have included that YouTube presentation. It was very short, but very telling. So for both of these reasons, As a policy analyst, I find this topic absolutely compelling. I mean, I'm drawn to it like a moth to a fly, you know, to a light. But that doesn't generally recommend it for public consumption or general interest. What does is this. This is a picture of Mr. Kerry recognizing that he had misspoken when someone asked, under what circumstances could we possibly not strike Syria? This was, I believe, in early September, or late September, and he said, well, if they got rid of their chemical weapons. And then they quickly said, but they never do that. Well, the Russians were very alert. They said, okay, I think we can work that out. By the way, they did. Now, this kind of set into motion a number of thoughts by a large number of people and made the awkward topic very, very warm, if not hot. Why? Well, it turns out in the lead up to this, I guess, not planned comment, the United States itself, at the assistant secretary level, was on record saying it wanted to hold talks on a weapons of mass destruction free zone because it turns out there's a treaty called the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and it is reviewed every 5 years. And the last time they reviewed it in 2010, everyone agreed, at least initially, even the United States, that there should be a negotiation of a weapons-free zone in the Middle East. The Egyptians, who chafe under the Israelis' program being in existence, were very eager on this point. And so we, in a desire to have an agreement about the NPT review conference, said, sure. As soon as it was announced, the president said, well, I'm not so sure about that little point about the conference. He said, it might not be practical. Well, the Israelis objected. In any case, in April of last year, Assistant Secretary Thomas Countryman said, you know, maybe it's time that we actually did hold that conference. Well, the next thing we know, the Russians are pushing to have the conference as well. And there are comments made about the chemical weapons by us, our desire to get them eliminated, in Syria. And the Syrians then say publicly, well, we can't get rid of ours. We have ours to counter the Israeli nuclear program. And they sort of say this. And then, lo and behold, the Secretary of State makes this comment, leading actually to negotiations to get rid of the Syrian chemical weapons. Well, it then occurs to everyone, well, this is the first step. Syria gets rid of its chemical weapons. Who's next? And so all during this period, even before our Secretary of State made this inadvertent suggestion, I and my mentor, Viktor Galinsky, who used to work at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, were thinking about writing a piece. And then this statement came out, so, oh, we've got to do it. Well, we did. Now, the existence of this op-ed is almost classified, and I'll tell you why. The New York Times, actually, when we suggested writing this piece, were very enthusiastic, and this occurred even before the Kerry comment that they gave us the green light. When we published it, it was a big, big hit in the European editions. They have something called the International Herald. There's only one problem. You couldn't find it on the New York Times website in the U.S. Now, I don't know why. By the way, it took us a long time. They forgot to pay us. I mean, it was almost as though it was an embarrassing thing that they had done. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to impugn their motives because, actually, I'm still friendly with people there. So, but it was a very awkward thing. In fact, there were letters sent to the editor complaining, why didn't you post this? So it isn't just me. you know, although pride of authorship, you know, would propel me to point out that didn't get the play it should have. But in this piece, we more or less focused on a point, and that is you can't really do a weapons of mass destruction free zone, which we, by the way, committed to do almost immediately after the Syrian understanding, if you're not even willing to admit who has what in the region. Now, I focused an awful lot on Israel's nuclear weapons. It's worse than that, though. If you go to our arms control compliance reports, which are done annually, you'll notice not only is there no discussion of Israel's program, which, as we'll get into it, entailed almost certainly now, with the release of certain information in the last 2 years, the testing of a nuclear weapon in the South Atlantic in violation of their pledge in a treaty form not to test in the atmosphere. But there's no mention of Egypt's chemical weapons program or Israel's chemical weapons program or the high probability of a biological weapons program in Egypt and one in all likelihood in Israel as well, to say nothing of other places like Syria. It's not there. What you're told in the Egyptian case is there is no evidence in the last year to suggest that they have proceeded with a program. Well, that may be, but this, in the case of chemical weapons, it's very, very, very likely that they actually have these things. I won't go any further. Let's just say if I did, I'd have to be taken and handcuffed and taken somewhere. So when we wrote this piece, it was a big splash in Europe. And what I'm going to show you next, it was not caused by this, but it's interesting how quickly things moved. As I say, I doubt it had anything to do with our peace. But then Putin immediately stated, you know, within 24 hours, you know, Israel's nuclear weapons program just makes it a target. And Rouhani said Israel must declare its nuclear bomb. And then there was a piece in Foreign Policy. Many Israelis want to come clean about their nukes, too. I like that phrase because it sort of rings from the piece. By the way, I got so much mail as a result of putting this piece together. I have decided only to brief outside of the Beltway and not to write any more about this. although it's really an interesting topic. All right. Well, first, let's try to understand. There really is a case against either the United States admitting that they have them or Israel. I mean, and I think you need to understand that argument. It has lots of different features. First, and we'll get into this momentarily, the Israelis believe they had a deal or understanding with Richard Nixon back in 1969 not to have to be in the position of admitting they had nuclear weapons in return for the Israelis never saying that they had them. In other words, we'll agree not to talk about it if you don't talk about it. And they even came up with a formulation that ran something like this. We will be not the first to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East region, but we won't be second either. One of my friends, who's a general in the Israeli military, said, you know, sometimes if you say something very, very clever, it just turns out to be stupid. And he said, what does this now mean? That if anyone gets them, we have to admit that we have them? He says, we've really painted ourselves into an odd corner with this kind of famous saying. Anyway, so the first point is they believe they had an understanding. To give you some idea, every president, when he comes into office, or she comes into office in the future, is met at the door by the Israeli ambassador. And they show them a memo reflecting what they think was the deal, and they asked them to sign it. Obama did this too. It was in the news. I'm not saying anything out of school here. So that's the first point. Second, U.S. laws could trigger sanctions against Israel's violation of the partial test ban, And actually, a few other things I was reading up this morning. It could be that if it became clear that they imported technology for their enrichment program, it would trigger sanctions. And that, of course, would be forced if we admitted they had them. I mean, it doesn't matter who says it. If that's what we believe, well, there are legal consequences. By the way, this means cutting off foreign aid and military assistance. It's a big deal because we give a lot of that to Israel. Then it also turns out that if you pushed on this idea of admission, you need to recognize there'll be tremendous pressure by lots of countries, Arab and European, to force Israel to turn off its major military production reactor, Dimona. But that machine is almost certainly being used to produce tritium, which is absolutely necessary to maintain the potency of the force. We don't know exactly how important it is, and we'll get into that later in this brief. And then this is sort of the softest point, but maybe the most important. Given U.S. reluctance to attack Iran, who has a suspect nuclear weapons program, if you made this announcement, it would only increase Israeli fears of being further isolated, and God knows what the Israelis might do. Yeah. They might say, okay, we're on our own. What do we want to do? So those are the arguments. Let's take one of them right off the bat. It turns out my mentor, Victor Galinsky, has gone to the Nixon Library repeatedly. Of course, he actually served during the Nixon years in the Atomic Energy Commission, so it's like current history for him. Couldn't find anything on this meeting other than that Kissinger wasn't allowed, and there's no written record, and there were no witnesses to whatever was said. What you do see, if you read Richard Nixon's memoirs, which are really quite remarkable on this, is that his framing of the issue had nothing to do with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty or non-proliferation. It was, you know, we really could use Jewish votes in Pennsylvania, and we need to get the Israelis to back us in Vietnam. It's quite a remarkably rude memo that's in his biography. He actually is so proud of it, he puts this memo that he wrote, this letter, he puts it in the appendix. In short, it's not clear that anything was agreed to, because at the time, the issue was whether we would send advanced fighters, F-4 Phantoms, and the State Department and even Kissinger was arguing, well, we should get something in exchange with regard to nonproliferation. I think Nixon's approach to this was, well, it's inevitable we're going to give you these jet fighters. And he called off something that was going on from the Kennedy years, inspections. We had informal American inspections of Dimona. Now, it turns out we've discovered that we were hoodwinked. We weren't shown very much. We were shown phony things. We didn't see all of Dimona. But he said, well, Nixon had gotten intelligence from the CIA confirming that in all probability they already had the weapons. And so he said, well, we won't do those inspections anymore because, frankly, if the inspections ever did show that they had nuclear weapons, it would put the United States in a funny place. So the agreement and its character is unknown. But there's a bigger question. So what? What if there was an agreement? It had to do with the Cold War period. The reason Nixon called off the inspections is he didn't want to have to say to the world, you know, Israel has nuclear weapons. Why? Well, if he did, well, the Russians would have to help Egypt get nuclear weapons. It wasn't in anyone's interest during the Cold War because of what the Russians might do, or, as I misspoke before, the Soviets. Yeah? There is no Soviet Union anymore. This deal and its relevance is worth thinking about. My hunch is not much of a deal, not relevant. Well, but wouldn't confirmation of what was a nuclear explosion in the South Atlantic in 79 trigger sanctions? The answer there is yes and no. They did ratify the partial nuclear test ban. This made it impossible to test above ground. But evidence is increasingly clear, and you can go to my website to read the historiographies that have just been produced by people who have come out and are starting to tell you what they knew and when they knew it. And it's quite technical. I have some slides on here for those that want to get a taste. That they did test the device, and it would put them in part in violation of this treaty. Also, if we affirmed that they had a weapons program, it would probably lead to the discovery of what every Israeli has seen on their own television screen. They have an enrichment program. They think they have pictures of these, and we'll see some of them. And that would trigger some other sanctions. Okay, that said, in 1998 there were tests by the Pakistanis and the Indians, and they were sanctioned under a number of these laws. We waived them. If we would waive it for those countries, we wouldn't waive it for Israel? I think this is manageable as well. Let's talk about the tritium. These are some pictures from a man, Mordecai Vanunu, who published them in the London Times back in, I want to say, 80... I always get this wrong. Either I say 84 or 86. It's one of those dates, I'm pretty sure. These photos make it fairly clear that the design the Israelis have within their arsenal includes using tritium. This material is useful in increasing the number of neutrons that fission the fissile material, in this case mostly plutonium. We don't know to what extent they use highly enriched uranium. And it produces a much more efficient weapon, either larger yield or smaller for any given yield. Now, it turns out this material, half of it goes away through radioactive decay in 12.3 years. So one of the questions is, how dependent is the design on tritium boosting? What portion of the arsenal relies on this feature? Is it the case that if you didn't have tritium, the bomb wouldn't work at all? Or would it be a smaller yield? We don't know, and it would require knowing an awful lot about the arsenal, the design of the weapons, and how much tritium they have and where they get it and how. Also, I think it's a mistake to assume the Israelis would, by admitting that they have a program, be forced to disarm either at all or immediately. There are a lot of steps that you could take to limit their arsenal, like, well, okay, stop producing fissile material. Maybe you can continue to make tritium, or stop making tritium and fissile material, or inspect a certain portion of this, that, or the other. I think people lack imagination when they just jump to the end game as the first step. That's not really how the world works, last I checked on these things. Occasionally it does. But even in the South African case, which I participated in, where we got them to give them up, it took some time. And there was a bit of kabuki for several years before anything happened. But no one is thinking, or should think, that that's necessarily what would be called for if there was admission that they had a program. This is an eye chart. Please don't read it. I can barely look at it. But we now are under increased pressure to do something about the weapons of mass destruction free zone proposition. And the reason why is it turns out we not only have a nuclear nonproliferation treaty that gets reviewed every 5 years, but there are pre-conferences for the review conferences. Well, guess what? Since the next review conference is in 2015, we have to do our PrepCon this spring. Yikes. Well, the first question some people ask, well, how are you going with that zone thing? Have you had any meetings? They had one meeting in October in Geneva, which was chaired by Thomas Countryman, Assistant Secretary Countryman. There was a UN Security Council-backed resolution in December. The Arab League is trying to somehow get to consensus on its position on this. The Russians are very keen on, doing another conference. There's a lot of pressure. In fact, even the Israeli president, Peres, said that Israel might, in response to what the Syrians have done, ratify the Chemical Weapons Convention. Well, in public policy, I always say two points make a line. You get one country getting rid of some weapon of mass destruction and another doing it. Holy cow, that's a trend. I mean, because it's so hard to get anything started in these matters. In any case, it's not going to be easy to walk away from this. Not only that, and this may be the most important point in the presentation. I mean, I think when Victor and I first wrote our piece, we said it's really outrageous that the United States and Israel haven't come clean, and a bit of moral indignation. I think that's misplaced. I think the bigger point is increasingly, and certainly over a long period of time, the Israelis themselves are saying that they have this program. And that may have consequences that we need to think about and not just wait for them finally say, yes, we have them. Because, you know, they have seen on TV a pictorial of the entire facility. This was done in 2004, recently updated. Peres, Olmert, both said in an indirect way that Israel has nuclear weapons. And the most important point is the Israeli censors used to force everyone who ever mentioned the Israeli program to say foreign press reports claim that. You know, you couldn't say, well, we have a program. Now, they're not enforcing that. In the last 6 months, they have not done that. Hang on here. Here's a good indication. The former speaker of the Knesset from the Labor Party has actually, in December, said, of course we have weapons. We should stop being childish about this and admit that we do. Then there is a book by someone who supports the program, Ari Shavit, that just came out. And there's a whole chapter where he interviews the people that ran Dimona. And it went through the censors. Not only that, there now is a little museum that you can go see showing a diorama and a cutaway of the Dimona reactor that's officially sanctioned by the government. So I don't know exactly what the motives are for this, but there's certainly an incremental and increasing willingness on the part of the Israeli government to make it look as though this is an accepted known fact, even officially. Now, that said, there's a lot of reasons why they might not admit. First, the U.S. certainly has a lot of incentive not to admit because we've done all these reports where we've more or less said indirectly they don't have them. So it's kind of embarrassing to then have to fess up, well, we did know, or what, you didn't know? Or, you know, how does that work? I think no one wants to be forced into debate about what to do. Even if you do a waiver, it's an awkward thing. It's a close ally. The Israelis surely don't want to enter in talks. The Israeli nuclear weapons managers have had almost no oversight over what they've done. There are cases of people getting overexposed to radiation who have complained they've been given the back of the hand by the government. If they admitted that they had this program, presumably those cases would be treated differently. Well, and then there's this point about, you know, would this push Israel to act even more aggressively towards its neighbors? Okay, well, of course, every argument has a counter-argument, right? What's the case for official canon? First, a little personal note. I worked in the Pentagon during the first invasion of Iraq. And there was an awkward moment when the Israelis were frightened that Saddam was going to fire chemical armed scuds at the cities. Now, if you know anything about the history of the Holocaust in Germany, chemical weapons have a special place in Israeli Jewish thinking. As someone who was brought up Jewish, believe me, it's a bad thing. They came to us and said, if you don't take care of this threat, we will. And we thought, oh my God, this coalition we put together with all these Arabs will just get shattered if the Israelis come in. God only knows. We panicked. One of the things we could not talk about is, would they use nuclear weapons? Now, I don't know, maybe somebody way high up could whisper the thought. But I can assure you, nobody in the Defense Department I know was able to. And I was fairly senior, and I was certainly close with people who were quite senior in that department at the time. You might not want to have a situation like that again. You want to be talking about what might happen. Also, if you had candor about this, it would ease the way out of what is going to look like a really hypocritical position for the United States, publicly favoring talks about WM-free zones, but kind of privately opposing them. You know, the Russians wanted us to put in the Syrian agreement that we would hold these talks, and we told them no, and then it leaked out in the press that we'd done this. It was very embarrassing. Also, I think the worry now is if Israel continues incremental admission that it has a program, we could be set up to overreact in lots of unpredictable ways. So you don't want them to set the situation up that you have to react to in awkward ways, such as having to enforce laws or have debates that you didn't want to have. If you could do this on your own schedule, it would be better. That is to say, cope with all the different issues that I raised in the beginning of this presentation. I think also we would give the U.S. and Israel greater moral authority in discussing weapons of mass destruction issues, nuclear issues, and give them more options. Right now, every time you go into a talk with the Iranians or an Egyptian, they say, well, what about the nuclear weapons? And you say, well, what are you talking about? Yeah. Also, it would allow us to be more candid about what Egypt's up to, which has been a big problem. I personally had an experience or two with that during my tenure in the Pentagon. We had to kind of, well, lie. I don't want to dance around it, lie about this. Now, this is a little woolly-headed, but this is a university. I mean, come on. You know, that's the whole point, isn't it? If you could forgive Israeli past violations of the Limited Test Ban Treaty or other things, it might allow you to forgive past violations by other countries. I put up Iran. I do think that's a pretty hopeless case. I mean, I am not optimistic about what we're going to be able to do about Iran at this point. But anyway, I put it up there. You might be able to encourage Israel to forgo enriching uranium or separating plutonium if you could get pledges from everyone else not to do it. Now, this raises the whole question of Iran. So maybe that's a little problematical too, but something to think about. You know, there is life after Iran. Do we say that we made a mistake in the case of Iran and walk away from getting an agreement, in which case we want to have the highest standards for everyone else, or do we make Iran into an example and a new standard, in which case you may not be able to convince anybody to do anything like forego making nuclear fuel? It's a question. You might be able to have mutual inspections or IA inspections that would go further as to what Israel's doing, and they might be mutual. You could have Egypt and Israel inspect each other's facilities, Algeria and Egypt inspect each other's facilities. There's precedent for this. Brazil and Argentina did this before they became members of the NPT, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. You could hold talks and include data about Egypt and Israel, which right now I don't think we're doing. Also, and I think, you know, pretty important, Israel is making a pretty solid argument right now that nobody in the Middle East should be making nuclear fuel by enriching or reprocessing. Well, okay. Maybe they need to stop in exchange for something that does lay that principle down. By the way, I think this is a correct view, the Israeli view. Okay, key takeaways. By the way, how am I doing on time? This is amazing. Will it be time for questions? If you don't want Middle Eastern states to have quick access to making nuclear bombs, you need to keep all the states in the region from making nuclear fuel. It's unrealistic to expect that you can do that unless there's some give on the Israeli side. This, in turn, at a minimum, requires U.S. officials and Israeli officials, perhaps, to drop the pretense that Israel has no nuclear weapons program. Certainly eliminating CW and BW are unlikely without a more candid discussion of the nuclear matter. And I would conclude, and maybe this is the most rebuttable, and arguably someone could come up with a good case against this last point, the U.S. should not wait to discuss these matters publicly, as waiting on Israel could be even more risky than us saying, yes, they do have them, and we need to start dealing with this. I have additional slides, but I won't inflict them on you. Well, actually, yes, I will. Any engineering majors? One. Two. All these soft-headed people here. Only two hard-headers. All right. Well, it turns out one of the things that helps detect nuclear explosions is a Vela satellite, or a bang meter, which essentially recognizes what happens when an explosion occurs. Initially, there's a burst of light, but then the light pushes and the explosion that emits the light is pushing up against the atmosphere and in such a way that the amount of light that goes to the sensor goes down for a while until it burns through all of that atmosphere. And so you get a signature that goes up and down, and it's quite unique. And these are the readings of that event. If you take that in addition to all of the admissions that have occurred in the last 5 years by people who are at various laboratories, not only looking at these images, but acoustic and telescopic radio wave emissions and the like, you get a picture that it's pretty clear they tested. And even the Israelis, to some extent, have told people privately that that's what it was. It was a low-yield artillery show. So anyway, that's just sort of fun. And I'm done. So we should take questions.
So we have a few minutes left for questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand. I'll come around with a mic. Please state your name also when I give it to you. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jamil. The question I have is more of a general question. Approximately how much does it cost for a country to invest in a nuclear program?
It's a good question. The short answer is less than you would imagine, depending on what they want and what they have. If a country has a civil nuclear program in place, what's required to go the last few steps is much, much less. Because they have spent reactor fuel. They'd have to break some rules, but, half the fun in getting a nuclear weapon may be breaking the rules. I mean, you're trying to shock people to begin with, show them how serious you are. In that case, you're talking about chemically stripping out plutonium and making a very crude device that wouldn't have much of a yield, but it would be 1,000 times larger than anything conventional, and that's a fashion statement in my book. So that is something measured in a few millions. We've done a study of crude enrichment programs using centrifuges of the old Soviet type rather than the ones that were stolen from Europe's Urenco operation, which is what the Pakistanis and the Iranians suffered. My wife's Australian. I've learned much about the Australian program. It was very inexpensive. It took 36 months, and it worked. Again, we're talking about a few million dollars. So if all you want is a few and you're willing to do it crude, the entry level now is much, much lower than it ever was in the past.
My name is Steve Bannister. Henry, you seem pretty pessimistic on the current course of the Iranian negotiations.
Yes. Whatever's
going on there. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Well, we're going to have a meeting. My nonprofit is going to hold a congressional roundtable with, 10, 20 Hill aides. And it's going to be on what the argument is for why Iran doesn't have the right to enrich, per se. That argument is one which, belatedly, the U.S. government has said it believes in, or at least the conclusion that they don't have the right. But they don't make the argument. If you make the argument, the actual argument that goes behind that conclusion, unfortunately it applies to more than Iran. Gulp. So we haven't articulated that argument. Now, you can't really win in a set of negotiations if your key argument for what they claim they have a right to do is one you can't articulate. So intellectually, there's a big donut hole in our effort. Then we have a couple of other problems. They are, you know, already got everything they need to make a weapon within 6 to 8 weeks. And this now finally has been admitted to by all the people who for years were saying, no, they don't. I mean, it isn't just our center anymore that says this. All the people who were giving us grief for saying this before now are saying, well, yeah, you're right. So that is a problem. And then finally, the Iranians are saying, look, we don't want to dismantle any of these machines. We want to build more of them. And I think the president is going to want to at least look like he concluded a deal so that even if Congress blows it up or the Iranians blow it up, not his fault. He can say, well, you know, I had a deal. You didn't implement it. And, oh, yeah, they got a weapon, but, you know, had you followed the instructions at the top of my box, you would have been home. So politically, it doesn't look to me like we have the incentives to do the right thing.
Tim Wells, one quick question for you. Given all of the quasi-official and official revelations since Vanu News 1986 exposure and the operational capability of the Jericho 3 ICBM system for the last 5-6 years, do you envision a palatable point, politically palatable point, where Israel will have the desire, it certainly has the capability, to devolve itself from the U.S. military and foreign assistance programs?
Okay. Good question. Let me give you a bad answer. Mm-hmm. In the short term, no. In the midterm, probably no. In the long run, you don't know, and I'll tell you why. The debate that matters most in trying to understand the security calculus of Israel is whether it will be still going through the motions of claiming a two-state solution or whether it goes for a one-state solution. Now, the one-state solution means it becomes more of a normal state, which means actually it becomes a Palestinian operation if you look at the demographics, and somehow it manages to improve its relations with the Palestinians such that that doesn't produce repercussions against them, and there is a new consensus about what Israel's about. Now, if you think, oh, well, that's all very woolly-headed and nutty, explain to me what's going to happen in 30 years. Because, like, I don't think anybody in Israel knows. This debate is going on in Israel. And oddly enough, if you talk to Palestinians in the know, they know logistically, legally, the two-state solution is DOA. They're not interested in it. So under those circumstances, yes, I could imagine it. There you go.
Thank you.
Okay. Think big. You won't be able to figure this out otherwise.
I'm Dean Chatterjee. I'm a student of political philosophy and international law. Could you tell us what happened after Jimmy Carter spilled the beans out when he declared that that Israel has probably up to 170 nuclear weapons, and there was some big storm after that.
As a private citizen, he said
as a private citizen, just about three or 4 years ago after his visit to the country.
How shall I put it? One of the neat things about our country is once you're the president and you're thrown out of office, you're just plain old private citizen. And if you're smart, you stop talking. If you're not, you just keep yapping away, hoping someone will notice. But by the way, it doesn't mean that what he said is wrong. But the consequences, I would say, not very great because he's a private citizen. And I would argue, as an American citizen, that's a good thing. I don't want former presidents creating any news other than that, you know, they got a new pet dog or they're painting or something, then, you know, that's fine. That's just the way we work here. We don't care about our past presidents, thankfully. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Charlie.
Yes.
I guess my question here, it's a bit of a general one. It's what informs U.S. policy in the Middle East? Because it seems like the U.S. is trying to serve two masters. It reached out to Anwar Sadat in Egypt.
Yeah.
Reached out to Saddam Hussein after the Iranian Revolution. Reached out to Jordan. Reached out to the Afghan Taliban in response to the Soviet invasion. And it's reached out to Israel pretty consistently.
Yeah.
Is this all real politic? Is it doublethink? I don't understand where you find the bottom
floor. You're asking probably a bigger question than I can possibly answer.
Well, and what is the, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what is the hold that Israel has over the United States that informs its very generous and munificent policy towards Israel?
Okay.
That's what I don't understand.
All right, sit down. Okay, yeah, I can, actually. I don't know how well, but I'll try, because it's a good question. I think trying to find consistency in policy areas where everything isn't working very well. And last we checked, the Middle East is really in transition, to put it mildly. You do whatever you think in the moment might improve things, and so it looks a bit of a hash. I mean, we have certainly a few keen interests. You know, one is we've got to protect the energy sources coming out of that region for not just us, really, mostly not for us, but for our allies, and to say nothing of the countries that are producing. That is just a fact. The second thing is, where are you from?
Philadelphia.
You've been down to Alabama?
Yeah.
You've been down south?
I lived in New Orleans
for a while. Well, you know, if you know good time, old time religion, you know what the Second Coming is about. Israel has a special place, not because of the Jewish conspiracy. I mean, although I kind of like that since I'm Jewish, you know. You know, that sounds great. But it's because there are an awful lot of people who are Christian who actually believe that it's essential that Israel be run by Jews for the Second Coming. Now, you can poo-poo this, but if you do, you haven't been down this and talked with folks who believe. Second of all, you know, there's a lot in Israel that is positive. There's a lot that's negative. I think we see a lot of that, and they're dealing with it. But, you know, that they have a former speaker of the Knesset advocating that they need to come clean and saying that, well, they need a one-state solution kind of suggests that politics there aren't totally dictated by whoever is running things, and that you can sort of say things and there's some free speech. And you compare that to other places, it does quite well. So we like that. We want others to do that in their own way. So that's part of the answer too. I mean, you know, I can see by the expression of your face you're not totally satisfied with the answers, but that's part of it. I think what I have said is at least part of the answer. Right.
Thank you.
Right.
Hi, my name is Brianna Kirkbride. I was just wondering if the government does come out and does say that they have nuclear weapons, do you believe that this could cause other nations to become hostile towards both Israel and the United States for not stating it earlier and not coming clean about knowing that it can happen and going against treaties that we have?
I'm going to give you a very sophisticated answer. It's kind of hard to understand. Yes. That's the reason you may want to be the one pacing events by figuring out what you're going to say, not waiting for this to sort of fall off the table in your lap. In a word, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today's forum. Please join me in thanking Henry Sokolsky for a wonderful forum.